If I strike my banners, will you spare my men their lives?
I made a promise to the dead, Cole. I told them I'd build a sept out of traitors' bones. I don't have near enough bones yet.
Welcome, listeners, to a Cast of Kings podcast, which is a Decoding TV podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I am, as per usual, one of your hosts, Jesse Earle, and it has been several years since I read Fire and Blood, the book upon which House of the Dragon is based, and I am joined by the one, the only, the amazing author of the unofficial guide to Game of Thrones and my fellow co-host,
Kim Renfro is my name, and I have reread Fire and Blood many, many times.
Yay!
Including recently, to be the most brushed up on of the chaos.
I'm assuming literally within hours.
Within hours.
Well, today we are going to be breaking down season 3, episode 6 of House of the Dragon, titled Faceless Men, which was written by David Hancock, who wrote episode 4 of the season, among others, as well as Shyam Poppet, hopefully I said that correctly, who is new to this show and has only, I think, written a few shorts and things here and there. And the episode was directed by Lonnie Pastieri, who directed the first episode of this season, which was The Battle of the Gullet, among others as well, over the past few seasons. Just before we get into everything, please don't forget, if you want to support shows like A Cast of Kings, please consider becoming a paid subscriber at decodingtv.com. To get ad-free episodes of the show, as well as our bonus episode where we go into all the differences between the show and the book. But with all that said, we're going to jump right into season 3, episode 6 of House of the Dragon with our spoiler-free thoughts, and then we will get into our spoiler in-depth recap in just a few minutes. But starting us off, Kim, what did you think of this episode?
If you're listening, you can't see my face right now. I'm squinting a little bit. This was a really mixed bag for me this week. I've been pretty strong on the season overall, and the opening of this episode like really grabbed me, and I kind of, my hopes got really high quickly that like, oh, we're in for some goodness again. and there were still some high moments here, to be clear. But I just started getting lost in the sauce as a viewer. I was like letting out all these deep sighs as I realized how certain scenes were unfolding. I just really left feeling like this. I texted you this, so forgive me for repeating it, but I was like, I feel like I am that mom getting escorted out of the throne room with a crying baby.
Yeah.
Because my sensitivities and needs are not what this world is being considered for anymore. It was a weird one. I don't know. How do you feel about it? I'm really curious to know.
Literally the thing that came to mind, and you said it, but like this episode is the definition of mixed bag for me. Because there are things in the episode that I think are really, really great, especially that opening, as you said. And then there's some stuff that I've been like, oh, this is a really good continuation of the story. I like seeing the just dynamics at play. I think some of the stuff with the Hightowers is sort of the bigger example of that. And then this episode continues storylines that I was at the San Diego Comic-Con this past weekend.
Fun.
And so I was like walking around all weekend and I was tired and exhausted. And I also, as you know, was driving back from Comic-Con and I got a flat tire.
Ugh.
So it was just a long day yesterday for me. So there was, I say all that to say is there were scenes in this episode where I was just watching, I'm like, don't care. I just yelled it at the screen, like, don't care. And I'm watching it with my partner, who is also walking around Comic-Con with me. So she was also equally as off. She's like, yeah, I don't know what we're doing here with stuff like the Aemon storyline, where I'm like, I just get to the stuff that I care about.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some baffling choices this episode, especially as a book reader, which we're not going to get into for this. We'll talk more about it in the bonus episode. But as a book reader, there are things in here that I'm just going like, what are we doing? And even as a non-book reader, I have to imagine that people are going like, what is this? Why do this?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a very, like I said, a very mixed bag where there are just things that I really do like. Like, I don't want to come out across as, oh, this episode was terrible. There are terrible things in this episode that I don't like. am I a terrible man? As one character asks. There are some great things. There are some terrible things. And so I just kind of come down as just mixed bag. And they're very disparate things. too, yeah, in this episode of like nothing, like the good stuff kind of doesn't touch the bad stuff. They're just very separate.
Yes.
Because we're sort of jumping so many storylines.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like a weird grab bag episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mixed bag, grab bag, all the things.
Yeah. All of the things. I did want to just address a couple things from our listeners before we get into our full spoilers and everything. Mostly this week was a lot of corrections for both of us. mainly me. All done in good faith and good heart. Nothing was mean or anything. So that's why I wanted to acknowledge it. If it was mean comments, I wouldn't even bother. One person said, please, 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 Jesse, pronounce Agen's name as I said it wrong, like every other human being on earth. I love you, girl, but please stop calling him Egg Gun. It's Aegon. And I will say, for some reason last week, like there's this thing that I do with names, mm-hmm, where I will start saying a name and be like, I think this is the right way to say it. Mm-hmm. But then I guess myself all the time because I forget names. Like people who've listened to me on my YouTube channel know that I forget names like crazy. Mm-hmm. So I always second guess myself and I always go with I'll go with the one that I think is wrong because it's probably right. Mm-hmm. And I end up being wrong half the time. So yes, Aegon, not Aegon, Aegon. So there we go. I will get it correct at some point.
It happens to the best of us. I feel like that happens to me with Velaryon and like not pronouncing it Velaryon. I think it's more Velaryon, but now of course as I'm saying it out loud I want to go like re-listen and double check that. But yeah, there are all of these like subtleties to George's language, and it doesn't help that he throws in new consonants or vowels or things in places that you don't always expect. And so
yeah,
thank you for the reminders of how things are pronounced. And we're doing our best.
Yeah. And then one other thing, too, is someone reached out to just note. You mentioned last week that Daemon's Knighting, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, that Daemon's Knighting ceremony of the Dragon Seeds was the first full knighting ceremony we maybe got in any Game of Thrones show. And one listener just wanted to point out Brienne of Tarth's knighting ceremony from, I believe, the final season of Game of Thrones that Jaime did to her right before everything going on at
the Battle of Winterfell, right? Yeah. It's funny. I think that what I was trying to get at is that there hasn't been consistency. Like, yes, I think that like that the knighting of Brienne felt like a full ceremonial thing. I have to go rewatch it. I really should. But my understanding is that like we keep getting kind of like these riffs on the knighting ceremony, and it doesn't seem like there's like one complete standard way to of doing it. Or if there is, we have not been seeing that consistently across. Everyone's
just been improvising every single time.
Yeah. Well, it kind of makes me feel like that the power in it is less about the specific script of words and more about an already established knight bestowing the honor and the oath upon someone else. So. But yes, of course, Brienne being knighted goes out in history as like the best knighting ceremony, hands down. And I am more than happy to use that as like the standard of like, okay, this is what's meant to be a full knighting ceremony.
I actually was thinking about it. We had a whole conversation about knighthood without spoiling for listeners who maybe haven't watched that show. But in Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, we kind of had the whole question whether Dunk had gotten a knighting ceremony. And then we kind of got one right before the tourney moment. Again, I don't want to spoil what's going on in that show, but there was that one bit with
but even that felt to me like it was kind of incomplete, we heard acknowledgement of like the mother and the father, but not all seven gods, and like other ones that we've seen have mentioned a few more of the gods, and again Ulf kind of like, I don't know if lampshading is the right term for it, but in this scene where he kind of goes like, is that it? That's what I was referencing, is that like it feels like there's a little bit of a meta conversation going on in all of these adaptations.
Well, maybe one day we'll see a full lighting ceremony, but it is not this day, to quote another fantasy series. But with all that being said, if you want to give us feedback and correct us or have comments that you want to possibly share with us that we may read out on the show, please consider sending it to acastofkings@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you earnestly and honestly. And finally, please subscribe to watch video versions of this podcast where you can see our lovely, lovely, amazing faces and see if Kim is squinting and being like scratching her head at the episode. You can do that over on youtube.com/@decodingTV, where you can also get the main Decoding TV podcast, where David Chen and Patrick are currently going through Dark Matter Season 1 in preparation for Dark Matter Season 2. I've been enjoying listening to that myself, so join them for that. But with all of that said, we're going to dive right into spoilers for this episode right after this break for our sponsors. We are back here with a Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV podcast. If you don't want to know what new incest we discovered this week, be warned, there are full spoilers ahead for this episode from here on out. But as per usual, just to note, we are not going to spoil anything from the book, but we'll save all of that for our discussion for our weekly bonus episode that is available to paid subscribers over at decodingtv.com. So please consider heading over there to support the show and other shows on the Decoding TV network. We'd love to have you listen to that because it's a lot of fun and we go really deep into some book stuff over there. We really, really enjoy it. That said, let us go into this episode with full spoilers with Kim's wonderful breakdown. We start off the episode with a high of the Butcher's Ball, a legendary moment in the Dance of Dragons between Rhaenyra's army and the Hightower loyalists still fighting in the Riverlands. Sir Criston Cole's life in service as Lord Commander of the Kingsguard and Hand of the King ends unceremoniously in a field, arrogant and yearning until his last breath. Kim, what did you think of this pretty awesome opening of the episode?
I mean, we all know how long I've been waiting for Crispy to get what's coming to him.
I was drinking coffee when you said that just now, and I nearly spit it out when you called him Crispy. I almost wish he had gotten burned by a dragon at the end here just to justify that so well. That's so good.
I had been anticipating this moment, and I was not disappointed at all. I think that the way it was staged, this sort of trap that the Riverlands army lays for them was so brilliant. It also like immediately put me back in the very cold open to the pilot episode of Game of Thrones when we see the handful of folks from the wall who are venturing forth to try to like figure out what's happening to folks, and they come across the pile of corpses, and it's like a mystery of like what happened, and then of course they get sneak attacked by the others. And so it was fun to see like the very human version of that, of like, mm-hmm. Oh, we also can play tricks upon one another. And just watching Criston Cole think that he is going to get this, you know, epic ending, that he's going to get to go out in a, you know, 2-on-1 fight, or that he'll be able to strike his banners and save his men, but like he will be the only one captured. I loved this inversion of that expectation and how he just gets very, very quickly dispatched with, by, of course, we see the arrows come from Black Alley, Alice Blackwood.
Yeah. I was going to say, can you remind Blackwood? Us who she is?
She's basically one of the leaders of the Riverlands who comes to join Rhaenyra's cause. We saw her very briefly in season 2, and then we saw her again kind of in the background of like the celebrations, mm-hmm. again after like the fish feed battle. And yeah, we'll get into how they might have changed or moved things around from the book in the bonus episode. But I do just think it was very satisfying to see Criston Cole shot down by a woman. Like one of the few women who's in this army. And again, like the parallels to Jace's death that we get with like the way that the three arrows are just kind of silently and very brutally appearing in his face, like getting shot right in like the cheekbone.
Yeah, that was a wild one to see. And I saw some behind the scenes stuff with the actor, and he had to, because they're obviously not shooting with real arrows, so he had to kind of mimic getting shot in the stomach and then like shooting his head back really quickly. It was like very fascinating to like see him like try to learn how to do that. Yeah, it was very wild.
Yeah. I thought it worked pretty well. Also, just getting to see Criston Cole in action truly right before his death was also, I think, like just beautifully directed shot, the sort of like the epicness of the moment kind of mashed up right with the, again, like unceremonious, very, this is just what happens in war. Like people die and you're not special type of attitude towards Criston Cole. I really thought that was interesting. And then, of course, like the layers that we see in it with him pulling out Allison's favor, like the handkerchief and wrapping it around, like truly the way that in his last moments he believed he was like righteous in his cause and doing all of this for Allison. Just,
meanwhile,
yeah.
As we see in this episode, Allison hasn't thought about him in forever.
No. And honestly, the I felt like we could have had better payoff of that, yeah, given it's weird to me that for the rest of the episode, no one seems to know that this event has happened. Right. I kind of wish that we had actually been able to see some people get the news.
Honestly, I kind of like that. I mean, I'm sure they're going to get the news at some point, but there's a part of me that does kind of like that no one knows. Again, his whole thing at the end of last episode was he wanted to go out in a blaze of glory. He even asked, like you said, 2-on-1 in this episode. And there's a part of me that does really enjoy that he has this unceremonious death, especially since he walked his men to their death and he didn't need to. And it was a very needless death on all angles. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he the news of his death isn't even really an event to care about for all the other characters in this episode. It's sort of a non-event. Mm-hmm. And the only sort of mention that we get is that he was causing pain in the ass for the Tullys and the Riverlands folks to get to Tumbleton.
Right.
So he's like, he's just at the very least, just like a thorn in Rhaenyra's side, but of no supreme consequence on his own terms. And I kind of like that. It feels like a very fitting way for him to go for all the choices that he's made. And what I really liked about this season, you know, is that the past, you know, few seasons, you know, we've come to really hate Criston Cole, deservedly so, for his misogyny towards, you know, Alicent and Rhaenyra, especially Rhaenyra, and his sort of putting upon her his sort of like, oh, you didn't want to go off with me, you wanted to didn't want to give up your birthright, all of that stuff, and it coming out in very misogynistic ways. But then this season reminds us of the lower class place, the world that he comes from, the lack of agency that he has, and the only agency he has is through fighting. But then he sort of enacts that same lack of agency upon his men and leads them to their death, even as he asks in this episode for their life, pleads for their life briefly. He doesn't get that. And that, again, is somewhat on him. Mm-hmm. Also, call out to our little Tully kid saying, I need more bones for the steps. Like, I was like, man, that's a badass line.
I loved Lord Oscar Tully once again. Every time he's on screen, I'm like, more of this, please.
Mm-hmm. He's fantastic. So I really thought that this was to wrap up the thought there, I like that they've given him a little bit of complexity. Like, I still think Criston Cole was a terrible human being, front to bottom, especially as he leads his men to death and everything he did with Rhaenyra, but they had a nuance to that. And I think that there's a tragedy in his ending here, as he takes out Allison's sort of handkerchief and she's got so many other concerns. She's not even thinking about him. And for him, it's like this big favor. Mm-hmm. I think they noted in the after show that like he was saved from suicide by Alicent, and that meant a lot to him. So, you know, I just like the complexities that give his character, even if they do give him a proper unceremonious death. I think that's a great way for him to go, but it is not filled with tragedy. So a very good opening, I think, for this episode.
Yeah, I again was like, woo, we're starting on a high here. Like, I thought it was just like beautifully shot. It almost felt like I was getting like a mini Battle of the Bastards episode with like just the level of fight choreography and detail going into, again, all of these like little moments that make up the bigger fight. Yeah.
Well, speaking of Alicent, the object of Cole's affection and loyalties on his dying breath, we go back to King's Landing and find that she and Helaena are discovered in the passageway by Rhaenyra's guards. This was, you know, I do like where they go with it by episode's end, so I do appreciate that, but I was sort of like, oh, they just get found immediately.
That
was like, all right, that was just a wild cliffhanger at the end of last episode, especially since that's not really a book thing for people who didn't listen to our bonus episode. So I was like, all right, where are we gonna go? And then they just get found, and it does lead to some stuff that I do appreciate, but my immediate reaction while watching this scene was like, oh, okay, I guess that was weirdly pointless. But Kim, what'd you quick think of this?
Yeah, I was also, I loved the transition shot to her and the way that the light comes around the corner to reveal that we're watching Allison sitting in the dark, especially as that, you know, symbolically links back to Cole's kind of like last gasp of breath, or not like last gasp, but like, I didn't mention this when we were just talking about the battle scene, but like, I love the way that Fabian Frankel played him being like,
oh like, yeah, getting like, exhausted,
but like exhausted, but like clearly full of adrenaline too. And like this almost like righteous energy that like what he's doing is the right thing. And like, ah, I'm going to kill everybody. And then the like, the scream of like, we light the way, which is, you know, the Hightower words. And then of course, like cutting thematically to one of Rhaenyra's guards being the one to like shed light upon Alicent. And then I guess it's like, yeah, I was kind of thinking that something more dramatic would happen to them inside those walls. But then as I was seeing it unfold, I was like, I guess that also makes sense that they would have just sat there in the dark.
Yeah.
Wondering what would happen. And then of course, like when guards presumably came to give them food or whatever in the morning, the guards then like came into the room trying to find where they went and went down the passageway. And then it makes sense that like then the natural consequences for this are that Rhaenyra like feels like she has no choice but to be a little bit more harsh on them. Because again, it wasn't like Missaria found them and that they can keep all of this secret, but it's like her own like formal household guard is aware now that they've been trying to escape. And then the fact that in all of that time, Helaena was able to kind of connect the dots and understand that her mom never intended for them to link up with Jaehaera. And so, I don't know. It was kind of the beginning of me being like, oh, what are we doing here? What's going on?
Yeah. Yeah. What are we doing? What's happening? what does it mean? What are we doing? But yes, it's because I do like that it does lead to Rhaenyra sort of having to crack down. I will say, you know, Emma Darcy is always fantastic. Those scenes that they have with Alicent in this episode are so good. They are just having a really fun time being like, I'm just done. I'm done with you, girl. I can't. I've been trying and you just spurn me at every chance. So they were really great in those scenes where they said they had a crackdown on an Alicent. So I did like that a lot. Well, speaking of Rhaenyra, though, we go over to her small council where tensions are flaring between Rhaenyra, Daemon, who wants vengeance for the Gold Cloaks, and the rest of the advisors. I do love that Daemon calls out our sort of Greek chorus of high lords here. He's like, oh, I'm not going to take advice from someone whose greatest battle was with indigestion. It's a great line. But Rhaenyra ultimately decides to send assassins to deal with Ormond and Darren Hightower and placates Daemon by telling him to focus on King's Landing. So I did really like this scene quite a lot. Again, the Greek chorus was a lot of fun. And I really did, again, Rhaenyra kind of trying to hedge her bets because she's constantly being like, should I just burn Tumbleton down? That would be the right thing to do in terms of just getting it all over with. And I would look bad as queen. So constantly having this sort of battle. And so she kind of goes down the middle. Is like, all right, I'll send assassins. And obviously, we'll see how that goes later on in the episode, but it's not a bad choice necessarily, sort of an option to go with. But yeah, it was really interesting. The other thing that I really did like here was Alan.
Mm-hmm.
Alan got a very good showing here. I'm like, oh, Alan, yeah, I adore you. You are just turning out to be one of the best voices in the show. It's always nice, especially in, because one thing I was listening to a reviewer talking about the show, and they made a really good point, which was, unlike Game of Thrones, where for the most part, everyone was competent at fighting for the throne and to some degree or another, here in this show, everyone's kind of incompetent for the most part. Which is a different point that the show is making, I think is interesting, because it's saying, like, you know, people fight for power and at the end of the day, a lot of people don't deserve it, and no one really deserves power, but especially these people who have no idea what they're going to do with it once they get it, like the dog chasing the car, the proverbial car. And so it's always nice, I say all that to say, it's always nice when we get a character who actually is competent and knows what they're doing. And Alan really did give me that vibe this episode of like, yeah, all the way down, except for one decision you make, which we'll talk about later. But as a player of the politics and war and all of these things, he is a fairly good voice of reason.
Mm-hmm.
But then I want to toss to you, Kim, what do you think about the rest of this? Obviously, you have some stuff with Missaria and Daemon in here as well.
Yeah, I mean, I did like this as what I consider to be a really like classic effective small council scene. Like, mm-hmm. we have been watching characters in this universe have these small council meetings going all the way back to the first season of Game of Thrones. And even though we don't have a quite small council in A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, we still, again, get these, like, okay, there's a small set of people in this room and they are making the decisions about what's going to happen to a lot of people around them. And I really, I love when you can feel how it's just these personal, like, personal grievances or familial squabbles or, you know, new guy bitterness that can literally change lives or kill people or help people. And just having to sit with, yeah, like, that discomfort of, like, watching sometimes the people with the worst motivations get their way versus, yes, it was very gratifying in this moment to see Alan be able to speak up. I think toe the line of, like, respectfully acknowledging what's going on, what Rhaenyra is trying to do, but also, like, holding his own against Daemon, which, again, like, it's unusual to see many characters be able to kind of, like, go toe-to-toe with him and not have things spiral. So yes, excellent showing for Alan in the scene. I also loved the moment when Rhaenyra admits that she doesn't want to burn Tumbleton because Varys mm-hmm. would have abhorred that decision. Yes. Also kind of like a throwback to when Rhaenyra was younger and she was the one insisting that Viserys send her and the dragons to go deal with, I mean, in this case, it was the Triarchy, so, like, not their own citizens, but still, like, it's, but again, it's almost painful to watch Rhaenyra admiring Viserys so much or still taking so much stock in what he would have done when I'm like, mm-hmm. no, girl, he was also making some serious mistakes throughout his run. Like, don't you do it too.
Yeah. Of course, we get a lot of parallels between her and Viserys in this episode, as we'll talk about in just a minute. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, we'll sort of continue on this scene here. We get a contingency from the Baratheon house here, which enrages Rhaenyra with the Lord's lack of urgency to come pledge fealty. But she used the envoy to her advantage, deciding to borrow their clothing for her assassination plot. What do you think of this little beat here?
I liked this scene, at least for, like, sure, let's bring the Baratheons back into the fray here. I don't think that we've really seen much of them since, as she mentioned, Luke was sent there as an envoy on, like, the very night finale. Or the next night after Aegon had been crowned.
And that was, for listeners, way back the season one finale.
Yes, exactly. And Lord Boros Baratheon was very, if you remember, like, when Luke arrived, Aemond was already there. And I believe that they have stated this in the show that, like, Aemond has agreed to marry one of Boros's daughters or had agreed to. Yeah. And so, right, Rhaenyra is basically at this point waiting on House Baratheon to confirm, like, nah, never mind, we're not for the Greens, we're for you all. And again, I did love Emma Darcy's performance throughout this whole episode. And you really see the emotions and the reactivity going on with Rhaenyra, depending on whether she receives the type of, like, you know, devoutness or respect or placating in the way that, like, she thinks she deserves. And it's funny to watch her kind of, like, try to take these guys down to task for not showing up with the news that she wanted. While I'm also being, like, she's like, it felt to me like she was both, like, a little bit out of her depth of, like, accusing this guy of, like, prioritizing something else. And I'm like, it's pretty obvious to me that he's lying to you or that, like, you know, like, that wasn't actually, like, very important to him, but they're just trying to kind of stay out of it for now is the vibe that I'm getting based on, like, the information drip happening. And at the same time, the moment when she steps up closer to the Baratheon man and you kind of watch everybody, like, almost flinch or, like, her Kingsguard kind of gets closer and you realize that not only is she putting herself in danger by getting so close to basically, like, a stranger in the house, but also they all realize that she could do whatever she wants to him in this moment is kind of how, like, the power dynamics feel like they're playing out there.
And it parallels a bit of with Ormond later on in the episode, yes. who kind of steps away from the false Baratheon contingency because of the smell. But we'll talk about that when we get there. But it is a nice little physical parallel there.
Totally. And I was also like, what does she want with his belt? And then it was kind of fun to see that, be like, oh,
that's an odd line.
That's what you're doing.
Well, moving on from that, we do see Rhaenyra later on holding court in the throne room where the small folk are clearly struggling without supplies like candles. And the Septas report new kidnappings now that the gold cloaks are gone. And Rhaenyra says she will light a candle for her, clearly wanting to do more, but not really being able to promise more and kind of now learning that. Rhaenyra has little patience and ultimately flees from the room when she realizes her finger has been nicked by the Iron Throne, which is, again, a parallel with her father, Viserys, from way back in season one, who also nicked his finger on the throne. What I will say, and this was odd to me, I'll be very clear, I did like this scene a lot. Again, that we got the crying baby sort of being escorted out, the patriarchy going on here. It was like, mm-hmm. Oh, women with babies, you're annoying everybody. Get out of here.
Uh-huh. No time to hear you.
Yeah, and so I did like all of that. There was an odd moment for me, though, I think it was in the after show, or maybe it was in the House that Dragons Built show. They talked about how this moment with the finger prick sort of like the wording was, this presages a lot of terrible things to come. Like it was like the way they worded it made it sound like this prick of her finger was the instigator for terrible things that are coming down the line. And I'm like, why would it be? Why? And I think they meant like it's a foreshadowing of it. But the way the writer of the episode worded it was just odd to me. It was very strange because it's meant to be symbolic very clearly of obviously Viserys and, you know, his disability that he had from the throne, at least implied to be from the throne back in season one. But yeah, it was just an odd wording, unless they're completely doing something very wild here. I was like, oh, I think you mean foreshadowing, not that it's literally a one for one causing the terrible things of this episode. But yes, I did really enjoy this scene again too, with Rhaenyra sort of losing her patience. One thing that I want to mention though is Missaria, and so we've gotten a few beats here. So as we'll later learn in a second, or as we'll talk about in a bit, Missaria obviously knew about Helaena's pregnancy and then lies to Rhaenyra in this episode about knowing about that pregnancy when Rhaenyra herself figures it out, learns about it because Alison tells her. And then we get these shots both in the small council scene and then here where we see Missaria sort of looking questioningly at Rhaenyra's choices, especially here when Rhaenyra is sort of talking about the women going missing. And obviously Missaria has a sympathy for many of the sex workers and women of King's Landing and Fleabottom because she has worked in that field. And so I understand that. But again, I'm not going to harp on it too much because I've touched upon this. It's just I just wish we've gotten more between Missaria and Rhaenyra to kind of really justify this, and it kind of something I've harped on enough, but it goes back to the fact that they had a romance kiss that the show has just not really been addressing. I won't go on about it, but it's just an odd thing of I just wish we had gotten more between these two to really kind of feel like she's being spurned more. I don't know. It doesn't feel like it's fully there for me. You know what I mean?
Totally. In general, I think Missaria is a confusing player at the moment because she's meant to be the mistress of Whisperers. She seems to conveniently have access to like key information at some points. And then I'm like, there are a lot of blind spots going on in your spying, lady. Like in this episode, we see her focused on the servant, which like, yes, that was one of the young women who was helping, who was trying to help Alicent escape. But then, right, like even the fact that she asks Rhaenyra, like she like comes up to Rhaenyra and is like, what did Alicent say? And I'm like, girl, don't you have children like hiding in the walls? Why do you have to ask what was just said in that room? Not that like she can't ever ask Rhaenyra to try to tell her directly, but I just found it to be an odd, I don't know. I just found it a little bit odd, and it was reminding me of the fact that it feels like Missaria should be one of the players who like is tracking the gold cloak situation and like the murdering and like those spies. Like how is she completely checked out of that? But again, they aren't giving us.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. No, that is true. It's weird that she's not involved in any of the gold cloak stuff with Damon. Not that Damon would want the help, but I feel like she should have like, well, I heard these people might have been involved. Like something, you know what I mean?
Yeah. When I think back to the previous people who have taken on this mistress of whispers role in this universe, they seem to often have a much broader network than what Missaria mm-hmm. is working with here. And either that is because they're trying to point out that Missaria has these blind spots, that like maybe she is so disgusted and disillusioned with Damon that she's not putting any effort towards it. But if so, she's doing her queen a serious disservice. And so I also am just, yeah, I'm just not really loving how it's, we're getting sort of just like these repetitive one note scenes between Missaria and Rhaenyra and not much else. And before we move on, I did just want to expand a little bit on this baby crying being escorted out of the room, because what is important, or what it feels like is important for me to point out, because we talk about patriarchy all the time as effectively one of the villains of this show, you know, like it's yeah. it is one of the forces and systems that is working against almost every character at every turn, and it helps most of the villains. And for listeners, I hope that people understand that the opposite of patriarchy, matriarchy, does not simply mean women in charge doing everything that men typically do.
Yes.
That is just women absorbing patriarchal values and practices and wielding them for their own benefit.
My big example of that is the Barbie movie. Dislike. I'm not going to get into it. I'm not a big fan of the Barbie movie, mainly because the answer that that movie provides to patriarchy is like, we'll do matriarchy with women. And it's like played as a joke, and I understand it's a comedy, but it was just a movie that was just like, we're not going to really push ourselves to imagine something different. It's just, we'll do patriarchy, but with women. I just call it patriarchy in pink. So like,
yeah,
a true opposite of patriarchy or different from patriarchy is a more flattened power structure rather than just women getting to do to men what men have done to women.
Yeah. Anyways, I mean, I've seen people point out before that it's like, if patriarchy is a pyramid and men are at the very top, matriarchy is more of a circle.
Yes.
And everyone, the people in power and the systems, are all sort of focused in at the center, which is protecting women and children first. And so this was such a tiny decision, but a very telling moment that shows you that within this castle, even though Rhaenyra is now in charge, even though Rhaenyra herself probably knows what it feels like to have a crying baby, or we've seen how her being a new parent, being a new mother, being freshly postpartum has negatively impacted her ability
to rule. She was breastfeeding, and she had her breasts were leaking during the small council scene, I think in season one or season two?
Season one. And again, that comes full circle in this episode too, when Helena asks Allison, like, why am I here? Did no one else ever want to marry me? That was the exact scene where Rhaenyra proposed that Helena and Jace be betrothed. And she was not listened to because people were so uncomfortable with her mere presence in that room as a freshly postpartum mother. And so the fact that Rhaenyra is now on the throne and has apparently made it known to the guards that, like, you should just take anyone with a crying baby out because, like, we don't want to hear that here. That's not a matriarchy. Like, a matriarchy would make space for and assume that the small folk coming are going to need to bring children sometimes, and that those people those people are just as valid and welcome to wait and make their voice heard. And so it was a tiny moment, but it really, of all the things that happened in this episode, I feel like that stuck with me.
No.
Probably because I'm in that season of life right now where, like, I'm the person with a crying baby. And it would be, no one has ever literally taken me out of a room, but I have felt that energy sometimes, but I have also felt the complete opposite so many times. Like, I have been in public with my baby melting down, and I have had total strangers come over and start, like, distracting him or like talking to me or just giving me like a thumbs up. Other parents with kids, and now like, I'm that mom when I go out in the world. Like, if I ever see a kiddo like having a hard time all of a sudden, I'll try to like distract them, or I'll just like give like a like, you're doing amazing to like their parent who's like handling them. And so again, it's like this, the state of things happening in this universe should not be taken for granted as like, that's just how it is. I think that again, we are watching a very deliberate system of power and values and who is loyal to, and again, this comes up in this episode a lot. Like, what does it mean to be there to protect your family? What does it mean to put your family or children before anything else, including your own self-interest or like your own power or your own money? And so, yeah, I wanted to expand on that moment because of all the things that happened in this episode. I feel like that was like the most crystallizing to me.
No, that's it's just incredibly insightful observation. I really love that. It's actually really great. Because, yeah, it speaks to exactly what you're saying. And it makes me think of, again, just to reemphasize this point of so often you see today so many people getting, let's just say, certain segments of the world getting so angry at things like feminism and things like that. And maybe the name is a misnomer, though it does center women, which I think is an important part of talking about feminism and the way our way women are hurt in our society and under patriarchy most directly, even though men are also hurt too, as something like Barbie points out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with things like matriarchy or feminism, they don't just mean women in charge or women first. They are things that we use to discuss, you know, how do we make a more equitable society? Because mm-hmm. patriarchy does hurt men, as this show has cleaned out.
Totally.
And so a lot of times people vilify feminism very clearly. It's like, oh, well, it's toxic femininity and women just want to be in charge and women are angry at me. And there's the misogyny in that.
Yeah.
But truly, if you understand what feminism is it is about, at least in its best form, about you know, evoking a more greater, more equitable society while focusing on the way patriarchy has sort of subjugated us all, and most specifically women, and uses women as a tool and object, and treats women as a tool and object. That's why it's called feminism, because it is focused there on that particular axis of structure, as opposed to something like discussing about racism, which is focusing on people of color and that axis. But ultimately, all of these things are here to discuss how we create a more equitable society.
Yeah.
And I always get angry when people angry may be a strong word, but I it's again the movie, the sort of popular version of like Barbie, where it's like all we can think about is just, we'll just do to men what we've done to women. It's like, that's a way our society ultimately propagandizes that, like, oh well, all we can do is just, you know, keep going down the long arc of history instead of truly envisioning something new. Mm-hmm. Anyways, that's my anarchist politics coming out. But yeah.
I love to hear it. And yeah, I wish more people knew the word misandry, because I'm like, feminism does not automatically equal the hatred of men. That's misandry. And that's just as bad as misogyny. Like, that's not the goal, you know?
Yeah, well, this gets into my whole thing. Misandry... There's a misandry implies like a structural like thing, like misogyny is like,
right.
Yeah,
it's like
there's
the
no
reverse
structural
racism card. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Like, yes, there are people can be misandrous. There are people who do hate men, angry at men for various different reasons. So misandry does exist, but as a systemic structure, misandry does not exist in the same way misogyny structure is a structure.
And it doesn't have in my opinion, it does not have a place in feminism.
When I read
like true feminist texts, like bell hooks, like the focus is constantly on the fact that women cannot combat patriarchy with their own hatred and want to oppress in return, basically.
That's a trope. It's a trope that you see constantly come out, not just with feminism. We're getting off topic, I should focus back on that. But like, it's a trope that you see constantly in fiction of like, oh, the revolutionary just wants to become the oppressor rather than to really create an equitable society. And that's like, there are revolutionary groups and feminist groups and things who do want that. And I don't want to say that's not a real dynamic, and it is a problem because you don't want to become the oppressor. But it is also the focus on that exclusively. And the idea of that exclusively is usually to propagandize desires to try to really change the world. And we see it too often in our fiction. Anyways,
I think
a sidetrack.
Hey, I don't think it's a sidetrack, because I think that relates very directly to what we're watching Rhaenyra do.
She's
whether she's conscious of it or not, she has failed to like come into this role with a true vision of how to revolutionize the way this works. And maybe that was never, ever going to be her intention. But I keep seeing these mistakes that are piling up within her court. It feels to me like it's because they are falling prey to simply trying to recreate all of the kings and their courts before them without acting as though it is revolutionary to put a woman on this throne. They had just leaned into that, or if the vision had been there for a true revolutionary movement, this would be a totally different show.
No, I mean, without getting too much into real politics here, but it just reminds me of people being like, look, Kamala Harris could have been our first black woman president. We could have had Hillary Clinton as our first woman president. And it's like, yeah, that would have been an important sort of visual representation. But it's like, oh, women and, you know, women of color can be the oppressors too, is ultimately, because it wouldn't have fundamentally changed the sort of American imperialist hegemony. Again, anarchist politics coming out here, so I will go too deep into that. But again, it is that important. And it's one thing I do really like about this show in comparison to the original Game of Thrones, if you look at Dany, because I think the show wanted to have a similar idea with Dany of she is still like someone of very much privilege and entitlement. And she's talking about breaking the wheel and freeing the slaves and all of this stuff. But it was very sort of white feminism. I want to be the white savior hero. And the show kind of angled in that direction, but kind of speed ran it and didn't really be self-critical of that trope, especially in its final season. But certainly even throughout this entire run, it didn't really necessarily break down that white savior trope as much as I think it really thought it was trying to do.
Yeah.
At least not in a way that I think audiences picked up on really until the end. And then they kind of bungled it too much to really hone that in too much. And I think here in this show, we are getting a much stronger version of that with Rhaenyra, where we are seeing, you know, she ultimately is still reifying the same structures that oppressed her and not really doing anything distinctly different. And certainly having her own mistakes she's making as an inexperienced leader who wasn't given a lot of training from her own father. But even if she was the most experienced leader, she would still be reifying the same structures of power that are ultimately harmful to everybody involved. So yeah, it's a very interesting look, and it's one of the positives of the show that I really do like, especially in comparison to the original Game of Thrones. But on that note, let us just take a quick break for our sponsors. Alrighty, we are back from our quick break. So we were talking just a minute ago about, people's focusing on family. So let's just talk about how Daemon does detective duty on his own after the Gold Cloaks resign, and he succeeds in rooting out one of the Hightower loyalists who gives his whole manifesto speech to Daemon. Speaking of anarchism, he is a soldier who was first seen resisting Allison's orders to let Rhaenyra take King's Landing unopposed earlier in the season. So yeah, I want to first focus in on that Gold Cloak scene. I did find it interesting, you know, all Gold Cloaks are bastards, so I don't really like these cops. But it was interesting about, like, again, how it just made me very fascinating to see, like, how these Gold Cloaks can resign their post, even in face of their king. Because usually you think it's like kings being like, oh, yeah, they have to follow to the letter of law, you can't do anything. But it's like, if you can't pay them, like, you ultimately don't really have power. And it speaks to that sort of structure of, you know, capitalism isn't necessarily true here in this world, but sort of money and payment and economy. So I found that to be a very fascinating thing, and Daemon trying to play on their loyalties and like the masculinity of, I made you men, you don't remember, and it not really working.
Words are wind.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that was a really great scene. And then I did like the scene where he sort of captures the one guy. You put in our notes here, so I want to call this out too. But I also did laugh at it. Daemon's disguise as a Gold Cloak, and he's just wearing that little helmet, and it just looks so doofy on him as he's wearing that helmet.
It really does. It felt like it like didn't fit properly, which like is maybe the point. But I was just like, yeah, he just. And like his like big chest kind of puffing out. I was like, this is hilarious. But I guess it worked.
Yeah, I do wonder if it's like there's a bit of pride in these. Like, it's just like, I think the way he played it a little bit is like, I'm proud to be a Gold Cloak. It's good. Yeah.
Strutting down the street. I mean, certainly when he walks off afterwards and like bumps into Ulf too, I was like, oh, you two both kind of suck. Neither of you were paying attention to where you were walking, or like which one of you shoulder checked the other. The soldier, I was a little, again, put it in the mixed part of the mixed bag. Like, a little bemused by this choice to call the episode Faceless Men. And like,
yeah, it was an odd
have choice. Yeah. And this was another time where like, I didn't know the episode title when I pressed play. So I watched the whole episode and then afterwards saw that it was called Faceless Men and was like, huh. And then I was like, okay, I guess that this speech from this guy is like really meant to be a bit of like the thesis statement here about like, I don't know. Something about the dialogue was like, landing
wasn't
a little
the faces,
weird
aren't
for
the faceless
me.
Men the people that
Bravos that trained Arya.
Yeah, Bravos, which we don't see any of this episode, at least that I'm aware of. Maybe. Yeah.
Right. No, we don't. I think that it's we see assassins, like assassination plots happening in this, and we hear Rhaenyra mention that like an assassin is best plain faced. Like that's why she's not gonna send Daemon. But yeah, it was a weird weird choice. And like this speech from this guy was giving me very like, you know, we are Spartacus. Like you can't kill any of, like you can't kill all of us. But again, I was like, is this a real network of people? Like, why doesn't Mas Arya know about this? Like, are there truly that many people who are ready to die for the sake of not letting Rhaenyra take over the throne? I think it's just to like beef up Daemon's paranoia, you know?
We'll have to see how it evolves in the show. We'll talk a little bit about Ulf in a second, but I think the way that scene ends was like Daemon pushing Ulf into the dirt. And we get shots of Fleabottom watching that. And you get this sense of, oh, look at these rich folks oppressing all of us. And it wasn't even that, because the guy who was giving his manifesto was like, kill one of us, more will rise up.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even about like him, Daemon, killing just this guy. It was the fact that like he is just oppressing the small folks. And I find that to be an interesting concept of like, look at the people of this world sort of rising up against the upper class. And I find that to be fascinating, but it kind of falls in a weird place here because this guy is working for Ormond, who's also a noble and also very much a, you know, a product of the another system of power, which is the church in this world.
Right.
So that's another axis of like where power comes from in this world.
Right.
And so it's like, it's a weird speech coming from him to give this sort of like, we the people will rise up and we, you know, it's the power comes, that whole thing.
Yeah.
And I don't mind that as an ethos. Again, anarchist, I'm cool with it. But it's an odd place to put it. And for a show, like we get characters like Ulf, who I love, and we'll talk about him in a minute. So we get some voice of it here and Alan and Adam sort of give voice to it here, but they're still sort of caught up in the nobility of it all. And so, yeah, it's just an odd, it's not an ethos that I disagree with, but I don't know if the show is fully, it's not, and it's certainly doing more of the legwork than say like Game of Thrones did, I think, in some regards on that respect. But I don't know if it's fully getting there in terms of what it's trying to angle for on that point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Mixed bag.
Mixed bag of an episode. Well, let's keep going on mixed bags. Well, here's the scene that I do like. I don't want to imply the rest of that. We have Aegon, I said it correctly, hopefully, and Larys are watching as Tyland digs a grave for the miscreant killed by Aegon. Oh my God. I'm going to keep messing it up.
I'm in my head.
But Aegon, last episode, attempting to keep the death a secret. Then each advisor makes their pitch to Aegon for either leaving Westeros or going to Lannisport. Aegon decides by testing whether Tyland will be honest with him about being a terrible man, the same that Larys was. Tyland fails the test, and so to Essos they go. It's just a very funny scene as Tyland just stumbles his way through this whole thing. He's like, I don't really know. Like, I mean, like, well, each of us, you know, if I was in that situation, well, sure. It was just so awkward.
And Larys kind of like wincing through it.
Yeah, like I love Larys's look. He's just like, what are you doing, bro?
He was like, this isn't going well for you.
Yeah,
I love that. I did appreciate that was the payoff for Larys having this big speech, because I think I mentioned last week, like I was kind of curious about the fact that Aegon didn't immediately lash out at him or didn't somehow like that didn't lead to like a cleaving between the two of them, but he really seemed to kind of internalize it. And I think that speaks to the truth that Laris was throwing out there. Like, he really mm-hmm. didn't need to embellish much. And the fact that his harsh honesty has actually earned him the trust of Aegon, I think, is a very neat way to kind of move this triad, this little trio dynamic forward.
Yeah, I've been really enjoying their scenes together, all of them.
Mm-hmm. And to be clear, I realized in my subreddit, I was like, to Essos they go. They said that the ship is like leaving next week or something. So they haven't sailed to Essos. I just want to make sure that I don't leave people with that impression. But that Aegon has agreed to plan that like we're going to Essos.
Yes, of course. Okay, let us start by let's start talking about the Dragon Rider drama this week. So Bela is inexplicably kissing her half-uncle, Alan, which I remember watching. I was like, wait, they're related? Like, how are they related? They're cousins? I was trying to remember how they were made, what type of incest this was.
Yeah.
Rhaena is being abused in the Vale, and Ulf succeeds into nudging Q towards rule-breaking like him, both with rather bleak consequences. So let's start with Hugh and Ulf are tiring of their watch duty outside of Tumbleton, and each have their realization that their lives aren't truly improved since acquiring this alleged great power. Ulf deals with this by deciding to disobey orders and try to drink in the taverns again, but this bites him when Daemon finds him, as I talked about a few minutes earlier. And then Hugh sneaks into Tumbleton to see his wife, and that similarly goes wrong. I'll just quick start off here. I will say Ulf is slowly becoming one of my favorite characters in this
show. Really?
I really feel for this guy. Like, let the poor man have a goddamn drink, you know? and I do think he's very insightful when he's talking to Hugh on that hill of like, look, you know, I thought that this was going to get me respect and these things that I wanted, but it really hasn't improved our life all that much. And him even talking to Daemon, who we saw in season one as Ulf, like, again, I like the way that Ulf tries to like reach out to maybe stupidly in terms of his, you know, not really respecting the fact that, you know, Daemon is a king, but still trying to like see Daemon as a human being. As he did with Rhaenyra last episode, where he's like, I'm going to go to the tavern. You of all people should know. And as we know from season one, Daemon was himself sneaking out to the sex workers and you know, going out and drink. Like, he has done these same things that Ulf does. And yet Daemon does not extend that to Ulf and literally throws him in the dirt. And again, oppressing the small folk. And so like, certainly Ulf is not exactly a smart man in terms of how he navigates this world of the thrones, though, to be fair, I don't think anyone really is in the show, as I said before, but I feel for him in a really cool way. And I think of all the characters, he is probably the one who I'm like, oh man, I feel for you, bro. I really do feel for you during those scenes. So what do you think about this? And then also Hugh, who I have thoughts about as well.
I think I'm like a little less soft on Ulf, just in terms mm-hmm. that like it does feel like so often, yes, he's like getting kicked while he's down, and I mm-hmm. that sucks to watch, and I feel for him mm-hmm. in that regard. But he also so frequently starts out these interactions as like an aggressor sometimes. Like even with this, like before he realized who Daemon was, he was like, "Watch where you're fucking going." And I'm like,
to be fair, I mean, if gold cloaks are bastards, so I'm like, again, I'm with you, Ulf.
Maybe I need to rewatch it again, but I was also like unclear on who even bumped into who in that scene. Yeah. And part of me felt like Ulf was the one who kind of
maybe, but again, I have no compunction. I mean, it's not a smart move to maybe go body clock a cop, but certainly I don't have too negative feelings about it.
Yeah. And maybe that's a poor example, but I don't know. I do at least appreciate that he feels like a very gray character of like, I don't necessarily back his like ethos about the mm-hmm. world and the way that he tends to interact with people. And yet he is clearly onto something here of just like the injustices of the way that everyone's being treated, dragon riders and small folk alike. And I really liked the scene of him speaking to Hugh as well. I also love even like the little dragon moment we get when they first arrive on the hill. It looks like Vermithor and Silverwing are kind nuzzling each other. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, are they dating?
I know, but both my partner and I, we were like, oh, they're so cute little dragons. Yeah.
More eggs on the way.
No. Yeah. Oh, God.
I'm kidding.
It's a romance. It's a wedding episode of House of the Dragon next week. Yeah.
I'm like, at least these dragons are having a nice time on this hill. I have really enjoyed watching certain scenes in House of the Dragon season 3 play out after having now experienced A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. Mm-hmm. Because I think A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms added such a good like depth and richness to both our understanding of knighthood and also the way that the small folk tend to operate when they are not directly being attacked or oppressed by a lord or a lady or a king or a queen. And yeah, like Ulf made a good point of being like, we are sleeping on the ground out here. And I was like, that is funny that they knighted you and you're a dragon rider, and yet no one thought to send you with like a tent and a couple of like stewards to attend to you. Right. Like, surely they have the capability to do that, or like if Rhaenyra really wanted to. And it does seem fair for them to be taking a bit of umbrage with the fact that like they're just being told to go do this endless watch duty with no thought to how uncomfortable that is for them. And like, we kind of get a hint of it too with like Bela, like, you know, Bela's sneaking naps in like I think that that's supposed to be like under the dragon pit. And yeah, again, it just speaks to like this oversight that Rhaenyra and Daemon have when it comes to people that they consider to be beneath them and not really going out of their way to consider their needs.
Yeah, we also get a quick scene here with Hugh going to see his wife, and sidebar, I think maybe killing a poor merchant man,
right?
Which seems out of character for Hugh, and maybe again speaks to his like descent into a sense of superiority, maybe, I guess.
That was interesting.
Self-focus, maybe, I guess.
This was so interesting to me because I thought that I felt like I was watching a bit of like a mask off moment for Hugh. Feel like we've remarked upon the fact that of the dragon riders, he's like the most sort of like stoic and quiet, and he doesn't really offer much of his personal opinion, and he doesn't show a lot of emotions very often. And that I feel like I got lulled into this sense of being like, oh, Hugh's kind of like this like stand-up guy, and like he's trying to be like dutiful, but he's not, you know, simpering about it, and he's being patient and blah blah blah. And it felt to me like Ulf like gave him permission to drop the facade a little bit.
Yeah.
And the reason I thought that was because of how casually he was like, hey, friend, and then just and like then just
tosses this guy in your
head.
Yeah.
Again, this episode and I think this season is so full of these moments where we are supposed to question or judge a little bit what a human life means to each of these characters. And so, right, like the fact that Hugh was so quickly able to, you know, take down probably just like a poor merchant or someone like a tradesman who was trying to get into the town or someone returning to the town just to get a glimpse, not to get a glimpse, but to try and get his wife out. But then the way that he conducts himself in that entire conversation was also, it was like I was watching like the red flags just starting to pile up, and I was like, whoa, is this who Hugh's been the whole time? But we just
Here's my thing with this is I don't dislike this idea with him, because it speaks to like the white knight chauvinism. Mm-hmm. Right, he was like, I wanted to protect you, wife, and so I got out and got a dragon, but then ultimately kind of ignored her because it was really about him. Like he did a mini Breaking Bad essentially. Mm-hmm. Of like, yeah, I was trying to protect my family, but actually he was doing it for him, you know. Mm-hmm. that's kind of what this little scene here with Kat was. And it was like well performed and well done, and obviously he sort of assaults her at the end there and says, you're coming with me, and it's a, again, his white knight's chauvinism and how that is an element of misogyny. So I do think that this is fine. And I think maybe it just speaks to kind of how quick they have to do this scene because they have so many other, you know, irons in the fire with this show. But I think my big problem with it is it comes across as just a bit stereotypical to me. This, it's not a bad move. It's not a terrible scene, but it's like I've seen this type of scene before in many ways. And there's not a lot of specific new nuance to it here with Kat. And it's, so it's like Kat is the victimized wife who just wanted her man home. And don't you understand it? Again, it's like, it's just kind of, again, I've seen Breaking Bad. And so this is a very, you know, she's Skyler Whiting it to a degree and kind of doing a speed run of that. And so it's not not inaccurate, not a bad idea or scene. It's not even terribly well done. It's just one of those, like, I watch the scene, I'm like, okay, yeah, there's not much to remark upon in terms of this show saying anything new or adding anything new. It's just a, yes, this also does happen under patriarchy. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It did feel like it was just a continuation of the punishment that, that Kat is receiving. Just as a character, and like her point in the story seems to be to really highlight and like put a face to the suffering that is happening. Mm-hmm. And again, you can imagine she's one refugee in Tumbleton out of many. And so when, again, we go through back to these conversations about like what Rhaenyra should do to Tumbleton, it makes sense that like we're grounded in at least one person there who, like, yeah, think of all the cats that are in that city. town. And yeah, it would be a terrible thing for Rhaenyra to do, to then just kill all of them. The only other detail that I did kind of like, but I'm not sure if I'm reading into this too much, is the way that Kat, you know, continued to basically like ignore this bid for connection that he's trying to make over like excitement that he's a dragon rider. And she says, like, do you know how many days it takes to walk here from King's Landing? Mm-hmm. And the first thing that popped into my mind was like, he has a dragon. He could have flown her. Or like he's been making this journey back and forth without actually having to be on the ground and experience the reality. And so that again speaks to both like his lack of true consideration for her and the point of privilege that being a dragon rider offers you, which is like it literally puts you far above the world that you are supposedly trying to protect and therefore puts you out of touch with it.
Yeah, she says something at one point of like, I want your feet on the ground, not up in the sky or something like along those lines. So yeah, there's some, again, it's not a bad scene in terms of like the poetry or writing and metaphor it is, but it is sort of like I've seen this before. And it, again, not inaccurate, but certainly not exactly a, maybe insightful is too strong a word, but not a super insightful.
Revelatory. And we got a couple comments from some folks that I was reading too after last week's episode, speaking to like the sexual assault storylines and the number of them that there have been. And of course, like there wasn't an assault in this episode, but there was a lot of discussion of it or like the threat.
And
of
he does get aggressive with her. He like puts his hand over her mouth. That's not a sexual assault, but it is an assault of sort. Yeah,
absolutely. Like it looked like he was about to try to kidnap her and then thought better of it. But yeah, I, this was just a scene where some of those comments were like in my head of like, right, this is the world that we're watching, like that these terrible things happen. They happen with shocking frequency perhaps. And it is meant to make us feel sad and uncomfortable that like, this is the quote unquote reality that so many of these characters are going through and that it very closely mirrors our actual world that we are in right now and the threats that people face.
I do want to move on, but I'll just touch upon that too, because I did see those comments and I agree with them. Like, I want to make sure our point was clear when we were talking, I think the past few episodes, about the depiction of sexual assault in the show. I think I've said this, but I'm not against sexual assault being depicted or discussed. And I think it is true, especially in a world as heavily gender stratified as this one, that sexual assault would be very common. I mean, it's very commonplace in our world today. And it would be more so back, quote unquote, back then. There's not a back in the real world, but like this type of era that it's evoking. So certainly, yes, it's true. My issue is less like with the amount of it or like the discussion of it or showing of it. It's just sometimes the way the show depicts it to me is always like kind of frivolous and also a little bit more like, ooh, look at the scary sexual assault. It's like this sort of like creeping like horror dread instead of focusing on the emotionality of the women who experience it, which is the things like I think of like the Allison scene from like episode I think 2 or 3 of the scene where it was sort of very frivolous and it was like, oh look, it's a horrifying scene because you're watching her get attacked and we never really get any emotional download with Allison after that of like how she felt about it or any, like there's just no real focus on the interior of a woman. It's just like the, oh, look how horrifying it is as it happens.
Right.
Like even Kat doesn't even get a ton of, like, she gets a little bit here, but it's more for Hugh's arc rather mm-hmm. than her own in this episode.
Yeah. And so that's what I mean by like her sister-in-law.
Yeah. And like the first episode too with Gwaine and Kristen Cole, the woman running away, and it becomes a conversation between Kristen and Gwaine, but not the woman.
Right.
So that's what I mean. It's like there's spectacularizing of it and not a focus on women's interiority or showing it. It's just sort of like, look at the horrors of it rather than going into it. And that's sort of my issue with a lot of the ways this show depicts it. Mm-hmm. Anyways, we've talked about that enough, so I don't want to harp on it too much, but I at least want to make clear my point is like, mm-hmm. not that I don't think it's untrue or not that we shouldn't talk about it in the show, but just some of the ways it's depicted specifically.
Totally.
Sometimes irk me. Anyways, we have a quick little scene here where Raina comes in and gets abused by Lady Erin because she left the secluded area of the Vale because she saw her sister here. We also get a cool little Moondor moment, which is a nice way of like talking about like the various ways that Westeros treat death and executions. But yeah, I mean, I'll toss it to you too, but this scene, this is the start of the stuff that I'm like, okay, what are we doing here?
Mm-hmm.
I shared last week that video from Princess Weeks that I hope people checked out. I'd recommend it again. She talked more about like the issues with Raina as a character of color within this world and how they sort of, the change from her being in the books, Sheep Stealer, sort of robs some interesting discussion of the pseudo white supremacy of this world, or sort of the pseudo white supremacy in terms of the visual of the show within the books. It was sort of like getting at the nobility aspect of the mm-hmm. series. So I highly recommend Princess Week's video. But here I'm just sort of going, what are we doing with Raina here?
Yeah.
Like we've had these scenes of like Raina getting abused by Lady Erin a bunch. I don't know where we're going with Raina, especially we'll talk about in the bonus episode the comparison to the books of what Sheep Stealer was at this point. So I'm just sort of like, just so many scenes of Raina getting abused and getting talked down to over and over and over again. It's feeling repetitive, and I just don't. I'm sure they're headed somewhere. I just don't really see it, and it feels like a kind of boring journey to get there.
Yeah, and this scene in particular, I think that this happened a few times throughout the episode, but was really showing me how like all of the people standing there in the room are watching this humiliation and abuse like go through the motions as well. And yeah, it wasn't sitting well with me that like we're just watching Raina get kicked around again. We're hearing kind of the same things from her about how she always wanted a dragon, and you know, it's like her monkey's paw that like, you know, she got it and now everything's bad. But yeah, I'm pretty bored of both Raina and Bela having almost no like interiority to their characters beyond what we've already heard them say. You know, they're really just kind of popping up for like these check-ins on how they're not doing well. And I'm like, okay, can we have them do something else?
Advance the story,
do we want to introduce a different element? Yeah, I also just didn't love any of this.
Yeah. And speaking of stuff I know we both didn't love, we do have a quick scene that I do like, where Alan makes a quick visit to Corlys to ask him to return to King's Landing, but his father refuses, but does agree to send Valyrian men. He does, however, give Alan the good tip that Tyland is in Rook's Rest as well. Also, there's a really great line here where Alan sort of calls him out. It's like, how long did it take you to acknowledge me? And mm-hmm. you're being all upset that Rhaenyra isn't doing the same for me.
Hypocrisy.
And then we get this bizarre scene between Alan and Bela where they end up kissing, where they talk about the shared relative Corlys and how tiresome being dutiful could be. So yeah, I love all the stuff between Ellen and Corlys. I love the calling out of like, how long did it take you to acknowledge me? I thought that was a really good scene. I even liked the dialogue between Bela and Ellen when they are talking together. All of that was all fine. And then I just sat there like, are they about to kiss? And I'm like talking to my partner. I'm like, is this where they're going with this? And then they do. And I'm like, well, and like, again, this is a show with incest. So I'm not necessarily, I mean, incest is not good, and I'm not saying it's great, but it's like, I'm not shocked by it, but I'm just like, what are we doing with these characters? This is an odd decision. And I was like, what a weird thing, especially as you know in the notes here, I'll toss it to you, like Jason Bela never kissed. Yeah, what did you think of this whole sequence?
Yeah, I was like, I was I thought I was watching a totally normal scene of Bela and Alan having a conversation about, like, we've seen them kind of talk about fathers before. I believe it makes sense that they are, like, connecting a little bit more as family. And yes, to be clear, it's like he's her, I think I said half uncle.
Yeah.
Because obviously he is Corliss's son. Corliss's daughter, Lena, married Daemon, and that it Bela and Rayna are Daemon and Lena's children, and then Lena died.
Kind of a similar dynamic in terms of Rhaenyra and Daemon, who, because Daemon is also Rhaenyra's uncle, lest anyone forget.
Yes.
So it's similar in dynamics for I mean, not in terms of like the class dynamic there, but in terms of like just the family tree.
Right. Alan is the half brother of Bela's mom.
Yes.
And none of them ever really knew about each other's existence until very recently. So it's not like they were raised as family, but again, weird. And yes, just as I was watching this scene, there's this moment, right, where Bela kind of like takes a step towards Alan and he like had this like reaction. And I was like watching it being like, why is he acting like that? And then I was like, oh, he's acting like that because he thinks that she's making a romantic advance on him. And then I was like, she is making a romantic advance on him. Like, I was genuinely baffled because we have had no indication prior to this scene that there is any romantic interest between the two of them, at least not that I have picked up on whatsoever. And I'd like to think I'm a relatively discerning TV watcher. And like, again, as this being the choice of where they're moving Bela's narrative forward after Jace's death, I was just like, what? Like, where are we going with this? Where's the logic? What the hell is Alan thinking by leaning into this? Like,
it reminds me, I'm going to tell listeners, this might get me some flack, but I do another podcast called the Frack This Podcast, which is a Battlestar Galactica rewatch podcast, which I watch with my friend, Vera Wild. And, you know, I loved Battlestar Galactica growing up. It was one of my favorite shows. But rewatching it now as an adult with her, with she's never seen it, and with fresh eyes, you notice this problem with that show of like every time a man and a woman are in a room together, the woman has to end up being kissed by the guy. Mm. And it's like, oh, we just can't imagine two guy and girl characters being in a room without it like ending romantically. And that's the only way we can think to like add tension and weird stuff going on. And it's like, for me, what was so interesting, what I loved, and certainly this is not my community, but I'm just sort of looking at what I've seen other people writing about. So many Black folks were looking at this family and being like, look at like this representation of this family in this universe. And like, this is very powerful for Game of Thrones visually, the way they've had some conversations like a few episodes ago about like talking about Corliss as their mutual parent and the complicated nature of that. So like really pretty handling it pretty well. And then we get here where it's just like, oh yeah, we're just going to simplify it to like, oh, now there's romantic tension between them. It just feels like the writers just not knowing how to write anything interesting, especially for Bela, like, because Alan's getting some stuff. But Bela and Rhaena too, to a degree, being like, just nothing for these women, especially these women of color. And it's just like, oh, all we can think to do is just having them be in romantic relationships. This show is kind of, it's a problem that I had with Battlestar Galactica, and it's kind of rearing its head here, because I think this is like one of a few times where we just like, all right, well, random romance now, because we just can't think of any more complicated dynamics to really eke out here.
Yeah, and really bizarre to me to spend this time on them kissing when we never had glimpses of this intimacy between her and Jace, and presumably her and Jace were actually like in love and very bonded. And
she's
like,
talked about that, how she had some feelings for him and cared about him. And yeah, you know, so maybe it wasn't like super, super romance, but certainly had feelings for him in some way, shape, or form.
And like last week, we had this scene of her confiding in Adam that she was feeling kind of like unmoored by the fact that, you know, her life was set up before her with Jace, and now she doesn't know what she's going to do. And I certainly understand, again, within this universe, a woman being fearful of simply being married off, as if like now the only value that she has is in a marriage. I just don't understand this this line of behavior from this character of Bela, because I'm like, is she thinking that winding up with Alan would be the best case scenario? If so, it's weird that we had that scene with her and Adam, where Adam was specifically kind of offering her this, like, you know, I would come get you, we could escape together. Mm-hmm. I didn't even necessarily read that as romantic, although I could see that as like having been a more romantic moment between them. Alan, so like for her to then go to Alan, and I'm like, what? I truly, yes, this was like a like hands in the air, you're starting to lose me show feeling.
Yeah. Speaking of losing us, maybe that's a bad transition there, but I will go with it for now. We'll get into the last part of this episode right after this quick break from our sponsors. All right, we are back. This is, of course, a Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV podcast. Please don't forget, if you want to support the show and get the bonus episode as well as ad-free episodes of the show, please consider becoming a paid subscriber over at decodingtv.com. But before we jump back into the episode, Kim, where can people find you on the interwebs?
I'm mostly hanging around Instagram these days if I touch any social media. So I'm there at Mick, M-I-K, underscore Renfro. Mick Renfro.
And you can find me at Jesse Gender on YouTube. I have a video essay about Obsession coming out in a week or two, so be on the lookout for that. But I also want to just quick shout out again my podcast, Starter Trek, which I'm doing with the wonderful Tawny Newsom and Andrew T. Tawny Newsom being one of the writers and actors from Star Trek. And we are going through episodes of Star Trek, and it's a fun comedy podcast. I got some props in next week's episode. It gets very weird and fun and wacky. So if you're looking for a fun, nerdy comedy time, please check out Starter Trek. But with that said, let us jump back into this episode proper. We have Rhaenyra and Alicent, as we've touched upon a little bit, have had several intimate conversations this episode, starting with Alicent being brought to Rhaenyra when she confesses Helena is pregnant and asks for mercy. Then Alicent realizes Helena has been telling the truth about seeing Aemond at Harrenhal, seeing a big emphasis on that. And she brings this information to Rhaenyra. Rhaenyra immediately sends Alicent off on an assassination mission. I loved all of these scenes to a degree. I have conflicted feelings on Helena, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the bonus episode, because there's sort of stuff that's coming up that I want to touch upon there. But without going into that too much, Emma D'Arcy kills these scenes, as I said before. I love their portrayal of just being kind of done with Alicent's shit, and you see this descent into, okay, I'm going to try and have to do some morally questionable things here. And Alicent even calling it out of, didn't I tell you that this was what's going to happen? Because you're sending a mother to kill her kid in order to save her other kid. And it's sort of that Sophie's choice that she's placed within that I think is really fascinating. And I really, really like that quite a lot. Again, I'll talk about this more in the bonus episode, but what I did particularly like, just on its own terms, was Helena self-harming, kind of like her mom, and like poking her fingers with a needle, and Alicent sort of recognizing this and realizing, like, I want to check into my daughter. I want to make sure you're, you know, satisfied. Are you going to be okay if I leave you? And being really concerned about that, because Alicent, as someone who also self-harmed, understands how hard it is and how hard she's advocating for Helena this whole episode, and the connection that she has with Helena over just like seeing herself in her and talking about, I wanted you near me, better with me than with some man that you didn't know. So that's why I married you off to your son. You know, it wasn't my decision, but I didn't begrudge it. All of these connections here were really, really good. So again, bonus episodes, I'll have thoughts on where this might be headed. But within this episode itself, I thought was a really well-handled section.
I found Alicent – I found her to be believable in how much she clearly wants to save Helena. But I also, through Helena's questioning of her, was also kind of coming to the conclusion that, like, yeah, Alicent is – just very lost among the consequences of her, her, again, she got groomed into the belief that she has about the world, I would say. Yeah. And certainly all of the choices and the ways that she effectively like cut off Rhaenyra from their friendship and their relationship at a young age, and instead was very much working with Otto, working with her own father, to undermine nearly everything that Rhaenyra wanted. It's like you can't unring that bell, and you can't. You also can't unring the fact that she clearly was not able to be very present for her children during their formative developmental years, yeah. And so it's like I could feel how Helena was sort of like, too late, mom. Like, or, you know,
yeah, I'm already screwed up, you know,
right? Like we're already living through the fallout of those choices. And especially, like, I found it very heartbreaking for Helena to what seemed like to for the first time in her life ask her mom, like, why am I here? In a way that almost read to me as like existential. Like, I understood that soon she was asking, like, literally why wasn't I married off somewhere else, but in a way I felt like she was also kind of trying to ask her mom, like, why did you have children, why are we here. The detail of her also starting to self-harm, and I noticed it again in some of the scenes with just Alicent and Rhaenyra, like Olivia Cooke was like picking at her hands, but on mm-hmm. her own hands, you know, like not opposite hand to opposite hand, but just standing there, like, yeah, just really going at her own self, and seeing the way that those anxieties are manifesting in her.
I will also say too, another acting moment, and I've already said Emma Darcy was great, but there's a moment where Allison touches mm-hmm. Rhaenyra, and the King's Guard, Queen's Guard sort of says, get your hand off the queen. And Rhaenyra just sort of like touches like her clothing and just like sort of like wipes it and like stretches it out again. She kind of looks at it. And again, it's this sort of like, don't touch me, I'm better than you. And this sort of sense of superiority that is, I think, been further reified this season that she wouldn't have had towards Alicent before this point, that I really liked. It's a good acting choice.
It was also such a good mirror for the scene back in season one in Driftmark when Alicent actually like cuts Rhaenyra with the cat's paw blade. Mm-hmm. And because that was such a you can see clearly how the dynamics have changed entirely at this point in their lives, because now Rhaenyra truly has the power to, like, if she had wanted to, she could have had that Queen's Guard execute Alicent on the spot. It was almost like, mm-hmm. I also felt like I was watching her be like, like, see, you can't just touch me and do whatever you want to me anymore. Kind of expression
vibe. Well, moving on, Harrenhal is a doozy this week. Alice Rivers is once again up to her witch tricks as she maneuvers to keep Aemond with her in the cursed castle. He's not convinced until she kills a stable boy in front of him and then presents him with a clutch of 5 unhatched dragon eggs. I have already said my piece a little bit on this, but so I want to toss it to you first. What do you think of this sequence in Harrenhal?
When I was first watching this episode, the only thing I wrote down for my notes under this was role playing. I was like, yeah. I was like, oh, Alice, it's like I was somewhat pleasantly surprised to be a little bit right after last week about, like, the only excuse I could think for having this scene of Alice being nearly attacked by these 4 men was that she was trying to play mm-hmm. a role of damsel in distress and draw out Aemond to kind of like come rescue her and then like establish
that. Playing as White Knight.
Exactly. Sort of, and yeah. So like, I was like, oh, okay, that really is what she was doing. She could have magicked them away faster or something. But yeah, it's not super compelling to me because, again, similar maybe to Bela and Reyna, I don't feel like I understand a lot of the interiority of mm-hmm. Alice and why she's doing this. And because we're almost always seeing her in this, like, I'm tricking you, I'm playing magic on you role, like, I also can't trust that what she's telling Aemond are her real motivations. So again, I'm just kind of left a bit bemused by, like, I like the setting of Harrenhal. I like getting to see a bit more of, like, this magic and lore side of the world. But yes, it's getting repetitive the way that so many other things are. And it was in the lower points of the episode for me too.
Yeah, for me, I just can't stand it. Like, I get what it's doing. they're trying to play a little bit of the Oedipal complex here with Aemon of like, oh, I had feelings for mommy in episode one for Alicent, and now I have sublimated them onto Alice here, and now we're going to bring Alicent in next episode, as clearly is evoked by the end of this episode, where she is sent to kill Aemon. And so clearly it's going to be a moment, this isn't any spoilers or anything, this is just me presuming, but it's going to be a moment of like Aemon being like, oh, my mommy that I love, I have sublimated my feelings for you onto new mommy. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this weird Oedipal complex that they're playing with Aemon, which is like, all right, fine, whatever. I don't really find that very interesting. And then it kind of adds on to this, like, oh, here's a temptation for Aemon of he could be with Alice and they have 5 eggs, so they could set themselves up as a new dragon lords. And I guess the interiority that I get from Alice is she really has this vibe of like, I want to be queen of Harrenhal. Like, I want to set up Harrenhal as like the new seat of power and become queen here, which is like fine, but it's so like, why would I care? Like, the show has done really no work to make me invest in like, oh, a Harrenhal faction now. Like, we have Darren, and we have Aemon, and we have Aegon, and we have Rhaenyra. It's like trying to get up all these different factions now. And of all of them, this is the least interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't care. It's done none of the work. It sort of introduces these 5 dragon eggs. It's like, oh, look, here's some things that could actually tip the balance of power here. And I'm like, okay, sure, fine, whatever. So I am just... it's like Oedipal complex, whatever stuff. And also with Alice, she's just giving such stereotype for women. She's like, oh, look, she's Oedipal mommy, but also trickster witch. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. It's like, okay, so she's just this weird archetype character. So I just end this out being like, I really don't care. I feel bad saying that. I don't want to be too mean, but like, I just, every time these scenes come up at this point, I was like, oh my God, can we just be done? I don't care.
Yeah. She's been way too isolated. I'm like, what would have helped this situation that we're in? And I'm like, part of it is that we don't have a single other consistent character who's also interacting with Alice. Like, she has no allies, which again, maybe it's her point, is that she's saying like, I'm so tired of being alone. So she just keeps like waiting for like one person to come that she can attach to.
The isolated witch hag, right, who wants power. Like, again, right, it's a archetype, you know, trope, yeah, you know.
And I was even like, are those eggs real? Because it's super convenient that you have 1 dragon, Rhaenyra has 6, and then she happens to have 5 eggs. Like, I was like, it all feels, again, very convenient for her to lure Aemon into this, spell with her.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not landing. I'm just blah. We kind of touched upon this a little bit, but Helena and Alicent's relationship for the Phrases episode, Helena is refusing feud and questioning her mother's lies and motivations right up until the Dowager Queen leaves to help get Aemon killed. So yeah, so we talked about the self-harm and stuff, but just wanted to quick touch upon that and Helena's deteriorating mental state. Anything to quick add on that? Okay.
Just that, like, a single sip of broth isn't going to sustain you for very long. So, like,
yeah, yeah.
The fact that Alicent was like, and I guess I will say that I again could very relate to this feeling as a parent of being like, it is so hard to watch your kid not eat. I've already like, and certainly to not eat by choice, but like anytime that my baby is like a little bit sick or teething and like appetite goes out of the way, it really throws me for like a special little mental loop of like, oh my God, he needs sustenance. I appreciated that, but then I was also like, Alison, like, one sip of broth is, and now you're like, okay, like, I trust you, you're fine. I'm like, no, that's not enough, which again added to me of feeling like, it felt like Alison's motivations here were more to like soothe her own inner conscience that she feels like she's failed her children, less about like truly being able to be there and understand and like be attuned to Helena and offer her what might help or might make a difference, instead of just kind of trying to force, be like, I'm not going to be okay till you're okay, so you have to be okay. And I'm like, that's not really solving the problem here.
Yeah. Well, this brings us into the last major section of the episode that we haven't touched upon, which is everything going on with the Hightower drama in Tumbleton. Gawain makes it to Tumbleton, and thanks to his presence, we finally get to see a more authentic side of Darren, which I really appreciated. The newly proclaimed boy king confides to Gawain that he hates being left in Ormond's control, and both Hightowers seem to agree they're all doomed. But Gawain saves Darren from the assassins thanks to his quick wit, and the incident seems to make allies of all the Hightower men once again. This was another strong part of this episode that I really liked. I loved getting Gawain sort of in this mix with Ormond, and you get to see a little bit more overt, the more overt ways that Ormond is cruel. Mm-hmm. Instead of it sort of being a little bit like, you know, in the background of these relationships, this simmering abuse that he has to Darren, where he just openly like says homophobic things to Darren, or sorry, to Gawain, excuse me. You know, and it makes sense for the character in the moment. So I was like, okay, that was interesting. I like seeing Darren being talking about like, oh, I don't like who I am when I'm near him, of just like being afraid. And again, that's how abusers go, is like you constantly are made to worry about their emotions. And Darren sort of being able to understand that when he has someone else nearby who is more enabling of him, mm-hmm. As a person, but still can't control himself when he's around Ormond. And Gawain sort of being like, I'm just done. I'm just very done. And wanting to just walk away from it all, mm-hmm. and abandoning Darren, mm-hmm. But also still like having like, yeah, Darren, you'll be a good king, but also it's this very complicated emotional dynamic that Darren has, and Darren even being like, I'm not going to be king. What are you talking about? You mm-hmm. know? And I love the sequence. Loved the assassination sequence, was great. Where like Ormond's like, the smell, and he just can't stand the smell, and so he walks away, mm-hmm. Which probably saves his life. Mm-hmm. And the Gawain sort of being smart and like knowing the tourney, you know, people at tourneys, and like knowing these different knights, like this is not the right guy, and mm-hmm. kills them. And then Ormond just vomiting at the end there was also very great. Of like, you get to see how like he's just this prissy upper class guy who just thinks everyone's beneath him, does not pay attention to people, does not pay attention to things, and just sort of looks down at everybody, and ultimately can't stomach the nitty gritty of a lot of this work. So,
dare I say he's squeamish?
So yeah, all of this was great, and I liked that Gawain being like, all right, what's your plan, man? Let's just hear it. Let's see how this goes. So yeah, everything here with the Hightower I thought was a really good sequence of events, and at least something a high note to end this episode out on for me. So.
Yeah, I do. I really continue to love how they've introduced and utilized Ormond throughout this entire season so far. And the detail of like the sound even muffling for us when the smell hits him, of like, oh, he's like, he really is affected by this. He's not just exaggerating it, type of deal. And then I also like the detail of one of the would-be assassins gets like gutted in the groin, and his innards and intestines and what I assume is shit and piss falls out of him. And like the fact that like Ormond like literally can't handle the smells and sounds of battlefield life, and yet he has the gall to, again, like, I think that he's totally just fitting this saying of like every accusation is a confession. He calls Gawain a coward, and he like says that Rhaenyra couldn't possibly handle killing people because she's too squeamish. And of course he means like emotionally squeamish, but it's like, you also literally cannot handle being on battlefields, even in this room. The hypocrisy of it all, I think, is very fitting for how he's supposed to be kind of like our big bad villain of the moment.
Yeah, no, I think he's a terrible person, a terrible man, some might say, but I do think he is a very compelling character, mm-hmm. and this whole Hightower dynamic between him, Gawain, and Darren is a very compelling and interesting one to watch play out. So I'm excited to see more of that. So that was a really high point of this episode.
I was also going to say, the only other thing that I liked about the Harrenhal narratives in this episode was the fact that Ormond saying like Rhaenyra can't kill, she's a woman, she's too squeamish, I thought had a very direct link then to the scene where Alys is the one who kills the stable boy who discovers Aemond. And that seems to be the thing that really gains his trust, because he, I think that prior to that, he also was assuming, you're not a killer. Like, you saved my life, you wouldn't
possibly. You're not someone worthy of my respect or too much of my attention.
Right. Other than, like, you're not actually that powerful because you're a woman and therefore you won't wield a blade against me. But watching her kill someone in cold blood, especially when she said, like, there's very few people left in this castle and that stable boy is one of them. Like, I thought that that was a good little manipulation and a good way to kind of like throw that line back in Ormond's face of like,
yeah,
what do you mean women won't kill? Again, reminds me of like Arya. Arya yeah. stabbing the stable boy was also like a big moment for her. Yeah. So many.
By the end of Game of Thrones, Sansa was murdering people with dogs. It was great.
Totally.
So, yeah. And we end out the episode, and we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, in my bonus episode, I should say, as well. The episode ends with a cliffhanger over Corlys's fate as Jon, Roxton, and Ormond attack them in the forest. Ormond's men.
Yes.
Yeah. Though the setting implies that the Valyrians will be hanged just like the pirates, we don't see a body. Corlys's fate will presumably be revealed next week. So, what did you think about this last little cliffhanger here?
I was caught off guard by this as well. I think for like the ending note of the episode, I think it added to me being like, oh, what are we doing here? What's going on?
It kind of feels to me like last week's ending too with Alicent and Helena Walls, where it's sort of like, well, we need a cliffhanger to end this out on. And the writer's like, oh, what can we do? All right, Corlys gets kidnapped or killed or whatever. And same thing with like, you know, last week it was like, oh, and they lose their light, so they'll get caught. And it's just like, okay, it's just a little bit of like, well, I'm sure we'll learn what exactly happened right at the top of this week, but it's just an odd, we need a cliffhanger moment. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And like, I was surprised to see Ormond's men pop up in that setting. I think I was even surprised that we were like circling back to Corlys at the end of this episode here.
Yeah.
So, I was like, oh, okay. He's going back. The visuals of all of these people hanging from trees was really unsettling, as it's supposed to be. And so that left me feeling strange. And then it also is clearly connected to this. It's like this dual cliffhanger of Rhaenyra getting sent a Baratheon tunic with bloody writing on it that says, kick this dog and it will bite your hand. Mm-hmm. And it took me a bit to put that together. I don't know if other people got this faster, but I was like, oh, this is them warning her that they're about to bite her hand. Like, Corlys literally is the hand of the queen right now. And so,
oh yeah. Okay. So it's a pun. I got it.
It's
got
a pun. and they like, they sent her back one of the Baratheon cloaks that the assassins were wearing.
That makes sense.
But honestly, for a second, I thought that jacket was Hugh's. I thought, because when he takes the merchant's clothes and changes into them, it is like a similar kind of like yellow tunic. But then upon second watch, I was like, oh, that's clearly the Baratheon sigil right there. But I don't know. Maybe other people were kind of, it just felt like a bit of a like unexpected and then, more questions than answers type of ending to the episode. And I didn't. I don't know. The credits rolled on this one and I was like, I don't know how I feel.
I have feelings on it that I think I'll have to elucidate a little bit more in the bonus episode. So we'll talk there. So please consider supporting us over at decodingtv.com if you want to get that bonus episode. But we have now reached the end of this one. Do you have any final thoughts overall, Kim?
I hope next week is better.
This episode, I like the opening. The opening was good, and there's bits and pieces and smattering. So this episode, it's just a very mixed bag on this one.
Yeah, and I fear I'm having flashbacks to season two, where I feel like I was really bullish on the first half of season two, and then stuff started I started getting lost in the sauce, and I don't like that I'm having that feeling again.
Yeah, we have two more episodes, so maybe they can turn it around and give us a couple strong, especially since this season they knew they were getting 8 episodes total, so they can kind of, structure it better than season two kind of ended, where it was sort of cut off at the knees a little bit by losing 2 episodes and then the writer's strike. So I'm hopeful. Like, the opening of the season, the first 3 episodes of this were super strong. The last 2 were okay, solid, but this one was a little bit getting into the doldrums. And so hopefully they can, this is the low point, and we can kind of have an upswing as we get into the last couple parts of this season. So I'm hopeful. you know, some you get low points in seasons. It happens. We'll see if they can turn it around over the next couple weeks as we wrap out this season. But this does bring us to the end of the episode. So don't forget to be on the lookout for that bonus episode later this week. If you want to get that, don't consider becoming a paid subscriber. And again, if you want to send us feedback or have any thoughts that you want us to read on the show, please email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Again, don't forget to subscribe to watch video versions of the podcast at youtube.com/decodingtv. And even more importantly, we adore you. We love you. Thank you so much, and we will see you next week for Season 3, Episode 6 of House of the Dragon. Until then, live long and prosper.
Bye.